This is Justin Roberts, and you are listening to Solid Monster Sounds Off.
I've had a fulfilling, happy life, but I wanted to know who my birth father was.
Truth be told, I'm not a very big fan of the black people. What the hell?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster Sounds Off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You're fat, Delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
This is episode 505 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, here for Battleground Sunday, July 23rd, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. I will have coverage of the G1 Climax later in the show. I've had some people asking me about this. Am I going to cover G1 this year? The answer is yes. Not everything from the G1, but the stuff that I see and the stuff that I think is worth watching and worth recommending to you guys. So I'll have my own little G1 report later in the show, including the tragedy that took place Saturday morning. A brutal murder at the G1. It's kind of hard for me to even talk about this now without getting all choked up. Unless that's just allergies, which is possible. But we'll get to that later. And of course, Battleground predictions. And we're also 1 year into the brand split for WWE. And so I thought it would make sense to take a few minutes to talk a little bit about where we are here 1 year later with the brand split. So a lot of good stuff coming up. First and foremost, though, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, always the easiest and best way to show your support for the show, you can do so on thesolidmonster.com. You will see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. And I want to say thank you to some of our most loyal supporters. John Loose Cannon Lopez. It would not be a sound-off without me mentioning his name. Deadpool James Herrera. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. The Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra. Hot Stuff Hector Pena. The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, who is celebrating a birthday tomorrow. So happy birthday, Derek. Always appreciate your support. Ladies Man Levi Daly. Damn Straight Michael Dorsey. Mass Grave Micah Harshaw. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray. Killshot Keith Hart. Radiant Ray Wrighton. Raymond the Mountie Medina. Mad Genius Matt Goss. Ryan the Dagger McTaggart. The Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, thank you very much. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Brett Brickfist Brode, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Better Than Raw, Robert Michalshek, the Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel Teh, the Columbus Destroyer, John Sterniker, the Asian Sensation, Justin Lowe. The Main Attraction, Jackson Scott. Adam El Grappadora, Nobles. And by the way, if Adam is listening, I tried emailing you back, and I got an address not found bounce back. So I'm not sure what happened there, but that might be something for you to look into. The Laredo Kid, Alberto Ortiz. Sven Too Crazy Pellman. Greg the Hammer Cammer. And Henry Shin Akuma Nelson. Thank you very, very much for all the support. I very much appreciate it. I had the chance this week to speak with former WWE ring announcer Justin Roberts. We had a long discussion, almost 75 minutes long, about his new book. A lot of stories from his new book, Best Seat in the House. And we cover a lot of ground in this interview. Common misconceptions of the role of ring announcer in WWE. The bullying culture in the company, at least when he was there, working for Vince McMahon and all of his insane little rules that he would make up. You know, we always hear stories about this stuff, and sometimes you wonder, is this true? Is this not true? Oh, it's true. It's damn true. Working for Kevin Dunn, talks about that. You don't hear a lot of, too many stories about this guy. Everyone throws his name around, but it's always interesting to hear from people who are around him. And in this case with Justin, Kevin was basically his immediate boss. So he had a lot of interactions with Kevin Dunn over the years, and we talk about that. what it was like for him being ringside when the Undertaker streak was broken at WrestleMania, and he was the one who had to make the announcement, and it was chaotic. So he talks a little bit about that. The suggestion box. You guys got to hear the story about the suggestion box. And I put that in quotes, that WWE would keep backstage behind the curtain. So anyway, if you want a peek into what really happens behind the scenes, I think you guys will enjoy this. I finished the book, and I've talked about the book before, how I really liked it. And I think it's an honest, straightforward read. There's a lot of negative stuff in there because he had a lot of negative experiences in the company, but he also had positive experiences. And I think he's tries to be pretty even-handed. And so I think you'll enjoy the book. I think you'll enjoy the interview. And by the way, if you want to get Justin's book for free, you can use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Justin narrates the whole thing himself. I know some of you who already cashed in to get the book had said that the audio version was not properly edited, and Justin hadn't been aware of it, the fact that, you know, there were a couple of points where, you know, he would almost start a line over again. That stuff should have been edited out by the company, and apparently it has been now. They've updated the audiobook version. It's all good now. It's been fixed. So definitely take advantage. I mean, you use our link, you get a free 30-day trial of the Audible service. You get one free book you get to cash in on. You get to keep that book, even if you don't stick around and pay for the full Audible subscription when the trial is over. So if you want to use it on Justin's book, it's a great book. Go ahead and do it. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And if you do listen to the interview, be sure to let both of us, myself and Justin, know what you think. He's on Twitter, at Justin Roberts. A lot of you have left some really nice feedback, and so I thank you for that. Given that tonight is a SmackDown Live pay-per-view, we should probably talk about SmackDown first, and so that's what we'll do. The commissioner of SmackDown Live, in what I think is a great metaphor for what has happened to the overall quality of SmackDown over the last month or two, was in a helicopter that crash-landed into the ocean on Wednesday. So Shane's biggest bump yet. He's okay. Everyone's okay. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was killed. He and the pilot, there were two people in the chopper, landed in the water off of Gilgo Beach out here on Long Island, which isn't too far from where I am. It was all over the local news here in New York. Shane was calm. He was a lot calmer than I probably would have been after an experience like that when he was out there talking to all the reporters. He was putting over the helicopter pilot, and he did a great job. He landed us safely, and then they had to be rescued by the Coast Guard. So anyway, he's very fortunate that this didn't end in a very different way. So thank God Shane is okay. SmackDown Live from this past Tuesday was from Birmingham, Alabama. It was the go-home show to the pay-per-view tonight. SmackDown Live Twitter poll. This is very interesting. So we had almost 1,600 votes. And this is the first time I can remember this happening since the brand split when SmackDown went live on Tuesdays last summer. We had an even 50-50 split. 50% thumbs up, 50% thumbs down, which for SmackDown is not good. There was a time when that would have been good for Raw, not for SmackDown. And I say not good, it kind of like this go-home show. Not good. Not good if the point of a go-home show is to get me interested in the pay-per-view and not literally want to just go home. This was a really boring show. This was a very, I think, uneventful show. We got to see the Punjabi prison the first time that thing's been set up, you know, live in the arena, probably in 10 years. You didn't really see much of anything inside the thing because it's almost impossible to see through. So, you know, imagine watching an entire match like that. But, you know, Jinder and Orton, they each cut promos on each other to put their championship match over here in the home stretch. Orton climbed to the top of the structure. You know, that looks impressive enough when he's sitting on top of the thing. You know, Jinder did an interview with some newspaper this week. I think it was in Philly, which is where the pay-per-view is, so that would make sense. And he admitted that he's afraid of heights. So I'm sure that'll be fun for him tonight. But there really wasn't much to it beyond that. You know, they just cut promos back and forth, and I can't say I'm any more excited in seeing this match now than I was 2 weeks ago. Renee Young, she had a sit-down interview with Chad Gable, who is now officially a single star, and he was quite shocked to find out the night before that his partner, Jason Jordan, is Kurt Angle's illegitimate son. He wouldn't have been had he listened to this podcast last week. But this marks the end of American Alpha. And I said it on Monday, and I'll say it again here. That team was criminally underutilized once they got called up to the main roster. Criminally underutilized. But having said that, I do think that Jordan and Gable both have big upsides as single stars. And I really hope that Gable doesn't get lost in the mix as a result of this. It kind of reminds me of the split with Cass and Enzo, right? So we know that Enzo just is not a good wrestler. He's not. He's just not a good wrestler, but he's an amazing talker. And so I think the future for him really is on the microphone or in someone's corner as like a manager or a mouthpiece or what have you. Maybe even an announcer at some point. I think Enzo could have a future as an announcer. But his future ain't in the ring. So in that case, you know, Cass being the one that has the bigger upside, they say the money is in him. I believe that. I do think that of the two, the money could be in Cass as the years go on, as he gets better. He's got the size, and I think that he could become a big player for them. I really do. But there was never any doubt when that team split up about who was going to be the one to get the focus, right? About who was going to be the one to get the big push. The guy's 7 feet tall. He looks like somebody that they would probably want to push into the stratosphere at some point. So that, to me, was never really in doubt. I think we always kind of knew who was going to get the better end coming out of that team. Here with American Alpha, it's a very similar situation, I think, to Cass and Enzo, where you have this guy, Chad Gable, who's not very big. He's an amazing performer, but he's not very big. He doesn't have a lot of size. Jason Jordan comes along. He had been in NXT for a long time. Directionless. He was around, but they weren't really doing anything with him. What they were wasn't really working. It wasn't getting over. And then one day he kind of cut, you know, he shaved the afro and changed his look a little bit. And he looked like $1 million, but he was still kind of vanilla, very bland. And they just stumbled upon this thing with him and Gable, and it clicked. And in NXT, they were, one of the most over tag teams down there they've ever had at Full Sail. They developed a chemistry together that was just so much fun to watch. They were so great. I loved watching those American Alpha tag team matches in NXT because it always followed a certain formula that just worked, right? So Gable would start, and Gable would be like a house of fire in there. Gable was just a madman, but it was a lot of basic stuff. It was, you know, amateur wrestling transitions, and the guy was like a little pit bull, and then he would make the tag to Jordan, and then Gable would come back in. Gable would get beaten down, right? And he'd get beaten down and beaten down until finally he made the hot tag to Jordan, and Jordan would come in. He would show this fire. He would pull the straps down, ironically, like Kurt Angle. Maybe he really is his son. But I love those tag team matches, and it was a formula that worked. But you always knew, right, looking at the two of them, if Vince McMahon were to look at them side by side, who's the one that you think he would point to and say, that's our guy, right? It wasn't going to be Chad Gable. It was going to be Jason Jordan. And so now both teams have recently been split up. Cass is the one getting the push, and rightfully so. And now Jordan, they've strapped the rocket to him now. And I can only hope that Gable doesn't go the way that ultimately I think Enzo probably will, and just sort of is mired in the mid-card and gets lost in the shuffle, because this is not a Michaels Jannetty situation here. I think both of these guys have, you know, top-of-the-card potential. And the fact that Gable may only be 5'8", he may be as tall as I am, doesn't bother me. You know, Shawn Michaels wasn't a very tall guy. Bret Hart wasn't a very tall guy. They were about 6 feet, 6'1". Kurt Angle. When Kurt Angle was coming up, it wasn't like he was the biggest guy in the world, but he got over based on his ability and his personality. Gable has that. And so that's my hope, is that that does not happen. And to me, if Vince McMahon cannot figure out how to make money with a guy like Chad Gable, then he has no business running this company. Simple as that. We had Mike Kanellis making his in-ring debut, finally, beating Sami Zayn. They set up a rematch at the pay-per-view tonight. Match was short. Zayn hit the exploder. Maria jumped in the ring. A referee tried to get her out of the ring, and in doing so, Bennett hit Sami with a closed fist, hit what Tom Phillips then called a Samoan driver, and got the pin. I don't know why Mike Kanellis would be doing a Samoan driver. I would suggest a different finish or a different name for it. I assume at some point we'll get one. Actually, JBL called it the Power of Love. So there you go. That's probably the name of the move. He didn't really look all that special here, you know, Bennett. Maria, let's be honest here. Maria is the real star of this act. You take Maria out of the equation, this guy has big problems. He's a capable wrestler. But you take Maria out of the equation, and I really don't think this guy is going anywhere. So you need Maria as part of that package. But we'll see, you know, going forward how far they push the two of them. Maria's great, but I'm just saying in this match here, Bennett didn't really... He didn't really have time to show anything. It was like a 3-minute match. You know, I mean, I don't know why they didn't just wait until the pay-per-view to do the first match, why they felt compelled to do this. It was a complete, you know, waste unless they just want to have Sammy come back and get his win back tonight, which I don't think he will. I really don't think this was necessary. The John Cena promo, the less said about this, the better. I hated this. I hated this John Cena promo. Not because the promo itself and his delivery was bad or anything like that. Just a bunch of fluff. And we've heard him say shit like this so many times, and he's going, oh, rah, rah, America. It's like, ugh, enough of this shit. You know what I mean? 1,000 times we've heard this already. Thankfully, Rusev attacked him, put him in the accolade. Cena passed out to end the segment. I just really did not like this, and I just don't have any interest in this match on this pay-per-view. I just don't. Becky Lynch beat Charlotte. A lot of rumors that Becky Lynch may be doing something in the future, some kind of angle or a match in WWE with Chris Cyborg, the Cyborg of MMA. Who is she? Is she with Bellator or UFC? I don't even know who she's with anymore. I don't know if she's with Bellator, if she's with UFC. She is she's quite the character. I guess it would be kind of unique. I don't know how much appeal there would be for it, but I guess it's still WWE person versus MMA person. It could be interesting. I guess we'll see if it goes anywhere. But Becky beat Charlotte here with the disarmer, got the tap out, clean as a sheet. That shocked me. It does make me think that Charlotte is winning tonight. Not just because she lost here, but they just haven't been doing much with her lately. I guess she can't be the focal point all the time, but, I mean, still, she's one of the biggest, you know, stars on the female roster, if not the biggest star over there that they have. I would assume they probably would want her competing for the championship. I mean, it would be a babyface match at SummerSlam if you did Charlotte against Naomi, but I could see them doing a match like that, and then when it's over, having Carmella come out and cash in on either one of them. We had the Fashion X-Files with Fandango and Tyler Breeze. It looks like now they're doing just more spoofs of TV shows, old TV shows each week. I vote, personally, if they're doing spoofs of old 80s and 90s TV shows, I vote that they both come out playing Larry and Balky next week from Perfect Strangers. And you know what? They could actually try to get Mark Lynn Baker and Bronson Pinchot to come and make cameos in the skit. Why not? Why not? They also spoofed the final scene here from the movie Seven. There was a guy here who showed up with a package for them. Tyler opened the box. He was horrified by what he saw inside the box. And Fandango kept asking him, what's in the box? What's in the box? And it turned out to be a horse's head. But not just any horse's head. It was the head of Tully, Fandango's stuffed animal, I guess. Man, there's a lot of stuffed animal deaths this week in wrestling. Also, inside was a note that had the word Battleground written on it, so I guess this thing will culminate at the pay-per-view tonight. I can't wait. Main event had Kevin Owens and Baron Corbin beating AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura after Owens pinned Styles with the pop-up powerbomb. You know, like I said, show is boring. I don't know what else to say. I have next to no interest in this pay-per-view tonight. Like, I was genuinely excited. I was genuinely interested in that main event at Great Balls of Fire going into that first Joe-Lesnar match. Money in the Bank. Money in the Bank is usually a pretty good show, so I remember looking forward to that one. Battleground, though, there's just nothing here. There's just nothing here. Which probably means it'll end up being a really good show because my expectations are so low. So, with that rousing introduction to our Battleground predictions, there is a pay-per-view tonight. They will be live from Philadelphia, which can be a tough crowd. So, I'm very interested to see how the Philadelphia crowd reacts to the Punjabi prison match. I think it's either going to be a total disaster, or this thing's going to end up just blowing away everyone's expectations. So I'm very interested to see how that turns out. But yeah, I look at this Battleground card, and I look at like Jinder and Rusev, and I love this idea that because you're from another country, that makes you an evil foreigner. Like, I had to like look and say, are we in 1989 or is it 2017? I mean, I guess Nakamura would be the exception on SmackDown right now, but you've got Jinder Mahal, right? The bad guy from India, even though he's really from Canada, which I guess still makes him a foreigner. Rusev, the evil foreign menace from Bulgaria, or as John Cena said a few weeks ago on TV, Bulgaria, because he's a fucking five-year-old. And Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens is the face of America from Canada. Like, these are your top heels right now on the SmackDown brand, and they all basically fall into that category, according to WWE, of evil foreign powers. And I just think it's so dated. I mean, you want to have one person like that, that's fine, but to have two or three on the same brand, I think is ridiculous. They're teasing a mystery match with Breezango against the team that's been trashing their office the last several weeks. There really aren't that many teams to begin with. New Day and the Usos, they're obviously occupied. They've already done Breezango against the Ascension. Absolutely nobody wants to see that. Primo is out injured, so that eliminates the Colognes. That leaves the Hype Bros, which is probably the next team to break up this summer. We've already had the Golden Truth break up, Cass and Enzo break up, now American Alpha has broken up. There's been rumors I've seen that they may put Harper and Rowan back together as a team and maybe do that match here, which I think is kind of a waste of Harper. But you know what? How much TV time is Luke Harper getting right now? Exactly. Not exactly a whole lot. So it might just be the best role for him right now. I still think it's an indictment on them that if that's the case, that's the best they can come up with for a guy who just a few months ago actually had some, you know, momentum as a singles, and for him to just be reinserted into a tag team, I think is a shame. But again, probably the best role for him right now if they don't have any other place for him. But, and this may mean absolutely nothing, I'm not convinced it's going to be Harper and Rowan, and I want to give credit here because one of our listeners, very astute listeners, Josh Zarkin, tweeted me, he pointed out that Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli, they've been on NXT television a handful of times over the last several months. They've mostly been working the live events down there in Florida as a team. Their profiles on WWE.com are no longer on the NXT roster page. I guess they were. Now they're gone. They were pulled. And so perhaps, this is Josh's theory, perhaps they were pulled early and the plan is to debut them as a new tag team on SmackDown. Now, it's just a theory, but not one that I've seen mentioned anywhere else. And they could certainly use more tag teams because of all the ones they're breaking up. So, you know, I would say if it's anyone but the Hype Bros, that might be the team to look at. And whoever the mystery team is, if it's not the Hype Bros, they're going to win. If it is Mojo and Zach, they're losing this match. That's the best prediction I can make. Because to me, it's very obvious they're headed for the exits as a tag team. The only question is, who goes heel? Is it Mojo that goes heel? I almost think it's Zach. I think Ryder is probably the one who goes heel in that scenario. Ty Dillinger will face Aiden English on the kickoff show. I'm going to go with Ty. How many matches have these two guys had? I feel like these guys have had at least three or four matches on TV since Dillinger debuted. And Dillinger hasn't exactly had a lot of matches on TV since he debuted. He did have a match with Jinder a few weeks ago, but they haven't really done much with him either. I'll go with Ty, just because, you know, I hopefully see bigger things for him going forward. And losing on the pre-show to Aiden English does not scream bigger things to me. But I think Ty, you know, once they get that U.S. title off of AJ, and it ends up on a heel, you know, I think someone like Dillinger could be a solid contender for a U.S. title, but you have to build him up to that level first. Sami Zayn against Mike Kanellis in Kanellis' pay-per-view debut. Kanellis got the win on SmackDown, and so you would think, well, Sami gets his win back here. I'm not so sure about that. I don't know that I would beat Kanellis this early, so I'm going to go with Mike getting a second win over Sami. Baron Corbin against Shinsuke Nakamura. They could go any number of ways with this. You know, Corbin has the briefcase, and so the attitude in the past has been so-and-so has the Money in the Bank briefcase, which I believe they're not calling a briefcase anymore. I think that might be one of Vince McMahon's new banned words. If you listen to the interview I did with Justin Roberts, it's comical. Vince's obsession with language and his obsession with banning certain words, and he once banned the ring announcer from using the word opponent during ring intro. That's how insane this man is. That's how crazy he is. So I guess now the rumor is that you can't call it a briefcase, it's a contract. I mean, I guess we'll find out tonight if they use the word briefcase, but that's the latest bit of insanity from the mind of the Irish madman. So, in the past, they've said, well, so-and-so has a briefcase, you can beat them, they can lose, because it doesn't matter, they're going to cash in at some point. By that logic, Nakamura win. I think Nakamura should win anyway. I don't think Nakamura should be losing here to Baron Corbin, so I'll go with Shinsuke for the win. We have a women's five-way elimination match to determine a new number one contender for Naomi's Glow Belt, I guess at SummerSlam. Charlotte, Becky Lynch, Natalya, Tamina, and Lana. Boy, do they love their five-way matches and four-way matches here on this show. I'm going to go with Charlotte. I just feel like they've not been doing a lot with her lately. There she is in the ring on Tuesday last week, tapping out clean to Becky Lynch. I just feel like they're setting us up for a Charlotte win here. I guess it would make more sense to go with a heel, like Natalya or Tamina, but I'll go with Charlotte. The New Day challenges the Usos for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. I think it's way too early to have the New Day take the belts. They can keep this going for a while, so I'll go. And the Usos have been doing tremendous work as heels. I've really been enjoying what the Usos have been doing. So I think they get the win here and prolong things for a while. Kevin Owens challenges AJ Styles for the United States Championship. Now, I said after AJ won the title at MSG that I would not be surprised if they did this, just to have him drop it right back to Owens at the pay-per-view. I say that's what happens here. And I know, again, I'm probably going against conventional wisdom, because what was the last sight we had on Tuesday? Kevin Owens winning with a pop-up powerbomb, pinning AJ Styles. I'm gonna go ahead and say that they'll do the title change and that Kevin Owens is gonna get the belt back. And if I had to guess, they probably will then go on to have one last match at SummerSlam and end the program there. We have John Cena and Rusev in an old school flag match. Some things are better left in the old school. What a lame return this has been for John Cena. I was just thinking about this. You know, that lame promo on Tuesday. This whole return ever since he came back, it's been so lame. And this is Cena's first match back on pay-per-view. He's representing the United States of America with the American flag. Who do you think is walking out with the win here? Right? Okay. I mean, is this even in doubt? To me, I mean, it's pretty obvious what's going on here. I mean, Cena wins. Cena's my pick. But I have to say, again, if this rah-rah America bullshit is the best they could come up with for this guy, then you know what? He's better off sticking to movies and reality shows. If this is the best they could come up with for John Cena here in this return, then I don't even know why he's back. Other than, I guess I do know why he's back, just to boost ratings. But, you know, surely they can come up with something better for this guy. You know, he is a free agent, so the quicker I think they get him on Raw doing something with Roman or Joe or someone, you know, that's the sort of thing that Cena should be doing. I mean, Cena's still a big name. He's a big star. This just feels like a placeholder match and a placeholder, like a cliched placeholder feud until they either get to the SummerSlam build or they just think of something better. But this is not a match that I have a whole lot of interest in. Speaking of which, that leads us to the main event. Randy Orton challenging Jinder Mahal in a Punjabi prison match for the WWE Championship. We have not had a Punjabi prison match since 2007. The year I started this podcast, in fact. 10 years ago. This will be the third straight pay-per-view match between Orton and Mahal. Orton has yet to earn a win. It's hard for me on one hand to believe that Randy Orton would lose three straight matches to Jinder Mahal. But you know what? When you're trying to make a new star, you do things like that. And Orton has been, you know, doing what he can to help, get Jinder to that next level and try to give him some credibility as a main eventer. I don't know that it's worked. Maybe for some people, not for me, but I guess in this case, the one thing that they have going as far as Orton goes, they don't have to pin him. Orton can lose this match without being pinned. I just don't see Jinder dropping the championship before SummerSlam, and even then, I'm not sure they take the title off Jinder even then. So I'm going with Jinder Mahal to retain the WWE title. And that's your Battleground card. Like I said before, I am not excited about the show at all. On paper, there's some good matches, but maybe because my expectations are so low, this will turn out to be a really fun show. We'll find out in a few hours, but this is one of those shows, I think, with the brand split and the single brand pay-per-views where you look at it and you just go, this isn't necessary. Raw this past Monday was live from Nashville, Tennessee. Thank God we were not whistling Dixie when this show was. I told you last week there was no way they were going to do this. Everyone was so worried about Dixie Carter. There was no way. There was no way. Raw Twitter poll, over 2,500 votes, 55% thumbs up, 45% thumbs down. So it beat SmackDown this week. SmackDown was an even 50-50 split. Raw was in positive territory. I want to say this might be the third or fourth week in a row. Brock Lesnar was in the news this week. He is the top champion on the Raw brand, so I probably should talk about this, even though it's all just speculation at this point. But the big rumor is that Brock Lesnar either has or will soon be re-entering the USADA drug testing pool in preparation for a return to the Octagon. Brock is 40 years old now. He sees his window of opportunity closing, and he wants to fight again and make a boatload of money. And the fact is that UFC has not had a very good year in terms of big, you know, pay-per-view main events and big box office fights. And Brock Lesnar with the right opponent is still big box office. He just is. He's an attraction. Now, what's interesting is that he is rumored for the UFC show at Madison Square Garden in November, which would be impossible, I would think, because if you recall, he was handed a one-year suspension last July for a drug test failure. Actually, two drug test failures, not just one, two. Once he retired in February of this year, he left the USADA testing pool. When that happened, his suspension was effectively frozen. Right? It's like when you want to use UFC as an example. If somebody has a certain number of fights left on their contract, right, unless they retire or something, it's not, you know, if you have two fights left on your contract, but you haven't fought in a year, you can't just say, well, my contract was for maybe X length of time and I want to go fight somewhere else. They're going to hold you to those one or two fights. They're not going to let you go walk somewhere else. In WWE, it's a similar situation where if you have a certain number of months or years left on your contract, but let's say you're out hurt, you're not wrestling, you're not performing, they can and have in the past, and they did this with Rey Mysterio many years ago, they have said, well, the contract is essentially frozen, so Rey can't just leave. Your contract is not over in April of let's say, this year, because you've been out for 12 months or for, you know, 15 months with a knee injury, and so we're not going to let you go. You know, this is the sort of thing that's happened before. So when he retired from fighting in February, that basically froze the suspension. Should he officially re-enter the pool, his suspension would continue from the point in which it was frozen, which would mean that I think it's at least 5 months before he'd be able to fight again, which would put his earliest possible return in December of this year, not November. USADA claims that he has not, so far, re-entered the testing pool. He has not given any indication to them that he plans to. This is all just rumor. So until he does that, it's only going to delay things even more. I figure that there is something to this. I'm sure he does want to fight again. I am sure he wants to fight again, and the allure of making millions and millions of dollars for a 30-second fight or a one-minute fight, much like his matches in WWE, right? They're very similar in that way. He can make a lot of money for wrestling 4 or 5 minutes. It's not bad work if you can get it. As far as it having any effect on him dropping the championship at SummerSlam, I don't see it. I don't see it having any effect one way or the other. If he drops the title, which I think he probably will, it's not going to have anything to do with him fighting again. And look, I know there's a lot of Brock Lesnar hate out there. There's a lot of people who have grown to hate or have always hated Brock Lesnar. People don't like him because all he does is suplex people. His matches are 5 minutes long. He's boring. He only shows up 5 times a year. People have all sorts of reasons why they do not like Brock Lesnar. I want Brock to stay in WWE. I'm one of the people that wants him to stay, that wants him to re-sign. I still think there is a certain level of excitement that he brings when he's around and when he's involved in a major angle, a pull-apart brawl on TV, if he's pissed off and goes nuts and starts killing people. You know, when Brock gets in Brock mode, to me, that's still some of the best television and the most realistic television that WWE puts on. And I think there's a lot of value even now, all these years later. It's been about 5 years since he came back, 5.5 years. I still think there's a lot of value in keeping somebody like him around. And I think WWE should absolutely try to keep him and sign him to a new deal before his current one expires. I think it expires with WrestleMania next year. So if I were guessing, this is probably going to be like what we had 3 years ago, where it comes right down to the wire and they're negotiating, and then at the 11th hour, you know, Brock signs a new deal. I think from Brock's perspective, I would love to know how much money this guy has in his bank account, how much he's banked over the years. This guy probably has just a mound of cash sitting in like some sort of chamber, you know, outside of his home in the middle of nowhere. Or maybe he has it stashed away like Tony Soprano had money stashed away in, you know, out in the backyard and stuff. But Brock, to me, would be insane to give up the WWE gig unless he wants to go back to UFC full-time at 40 years old, and then he can make a shitload of money just doing, you know, 2 or 3 fights a year. But why you would give up the money that he's making, the millions of dollars that this guy is making for almost nothing from WWE? It's easy money, minimal travel, everybody kisses your ass, you come and go as you please. You know, you cash your paycheck. There is no better gig in wrestling than the one that Brock Lesnar has. And again, he's not getting any younger. He has got the best job in the world. Why would you want to give that up? So I think it's in the best interest of both sides to get a deal done and to keep him around. And if he can convince Vince McMahon to let him do a UFC fight here and there, even better. Vince let him do the last fight. There's no reason to think Vince wouldn't let him do another one. Now, if it conflicts with WrestleMania season, I could see that being a problem. But otherwise, I mean, Vince McMahon has shown a great flexibility with Brock Lesnar that he has not shown with other people in the past. Maybe I just wouldn't put the title on him so your champion is off TV for months at a time, but I would definitely keep him around for matches on big shows. There were two big angles on Raw this week. Roman Reigns and Samoa Joe went to a no contest when Braun Strowman returned. He attacked both men. Clearly, this is going to set up a fatal four-way at SummerSlam. I think it's the only move to make. They would be insane to do anything else. I would like to see Samoa Joe get the title. Sadly, I think the wrong Samoan named Joe will probably wind up getting the championship, and I think that would be a mistake. The other angle involved Kurt Angle. And the big reveal that was, while he was in college at Clarion University, he dated a girl. That was his big revelation. No, I'm kidding. That was not his big revelation. He only recently learned that she gave birth, 9 months later, to a baby boy. And this was very disappointing for me to hear this, especially when I remember watching a young Kurt Angle on Monday Night Raw back around 2000. Okay, this was not long after he debuted, talking about the joys of abstinence. He's on TV preaching the joys of celibacy and abstinence and handing Godfather a condom. He literally stood in the ring with a condom to hand to the Godfather. Kurt should have taken his own advice. Should have wrapped that thing up. So he said the baby boy was put up for a closed adoption and went on to become a three-sport athlete. As soon as he said three-sport athlete, I knew it was Jordan. I went on Twitter, I'm like, it's Jordan. Like 5 minutes before he even announced it. Because I still, maybe I'm one of the only ones who remembers this. That's the one thing I remember the announcers saying over and over and over again when Jordan first debuted in NXT, back when he had the giant afro. He's a three-sport athlete. He's a three-sport athlete. He plays baseball and this and that. And as soon as Kurt said that, I knew exactly who it was. And Kurt said that he was drafted to play professional baseball, but this person instead, his son, chose to get into wrestling and pursued his dream of becoming a WWE superstar. And he then introduced the newest member of the Raw roster, his son, Jason Jordan of American Alpha. And Jordan came out, and the two hugged in the middle of the ring, and Kurt's acting, I will say, his acting here was pretty good, especially if you're somebody like me who has seen some of the B-movies that Kurt Angle did while he was still working for TNA. There was one where he was a police chief, I think, in some town in the middle of nowhere. And Kevin Nash and Psycho Sid played zombies in the movie. Compared to the movies that he did back then, he was fucking Meryl Streep out here during this segment. So kudos to Kurt. This is what Kurt, by the way, said on Facebook, on his official Facebook page. He said, "I thought to myself what it would be like to see my son Cody for the first time ever and didn't know it for 20 years. I thought if this were real, how would I feel?" And so that's what he thought about before he went out there to do this fine acting job. The tie-in with Corey Graves, because you remember Corey Graves has been tied into the storyline from the very beginning. The tie-in here is that Graves and Jordan have been friends for years, going back to their days in NXT. And Jason confided in him a long time ago that Kurt was his dad. So that's the tie-in with Graves. The crowd who gave Kurt the what treatment throughout this entire thing, okay, this crowd in Nashville, pretty quiet for the big reveal. I mean, they kind of popped when the two of them hugged initially, but you could tell people just weren't buying this. Now, I had hoped that it would be Chad Gable. I said as much here on the podcast last week. Although I did say, as many of you pointed out, I don't take credit for having gotten this right or anything. I said it was Chad. It wasn't Chad. It was the other one. But I did say last week, watch them swerve. Watch them swerve us and make it Jordan instead. I wanted it to be Gable because it's a high-profile spot on TV. And I thought that the interplay and the banter with him and Curtis, his dad, could be entertaining. Obviously, this is a stupid storyline, okay? I'm not denying that. It is a very, very stupid storyline. Nobody buys any of it. And we probably should not be surprised by the whole illegitimate kid storyline being the brainchild, apparently, of Vince McMahon himself. So this is not something that was pitched by an agent or by Kurt or by one of the writers. This was a Vince McMahon idea. Surprise, surprise. Is it stupid? Yes. Can it work? Absolutely. Yes, it can. You could take even some of the dumbest ideas and make them work if you're smart enough. And this could have worked for Chad Gable as well. And it could work for Jason Jordan. But if it doesn't, I see a lot of people saying, this is it. This is the end of Jason Jordan's career. They've tainted him for the rest of his life. This is not career suicide. There is a very easy way out of this, which is just to have Jordan, at some point down the road, reveal that he is in fact not Kurt Angle's son, and the whole thing was just a giant ruse. Maybe even planned out with him and Corey Graves. They can say that they conspired together to help get Jason Jordan a top spot on Raw, to get away from Chad Gable, and to get a top spot on the flagship show. And he tried to leech off of Kurt Angle's name and his Olympic credentials to gain fame and fortune. He used him. And then from there, Jordan becomes a big heel. He doesn't have to be Kurt Angle's son for the rest of his career. There's no law that says that he's forever going to be branded as Kurt Angle's son. They can get out of this if they want to down the road. He doesn't have to be Kurt Angle's son for the rest of his career. And looking ahead, to me, the WrestleMania match is obviously going to be Kurt Angle against Jason Jordan. Otherwise, what's the point of this? If this doesn't lead to a match, and probably a match at WrestleMania between the two of them, then I don't know what the whole point of this was. Other than just to come up with some stupid storyline on TV to pop a rating, which it seems to work. It seems to have worked. I don't know if that's good or bad, because that just means we're going to have more of these in the future. But to me, that's the WrestleMania match, and if you do that match, Jordan should go heel before then. Now, I'm looking ahead, before any match with Kurt at WrestleMania or anything, I'm looking ahead. So what do you do with Jordan now, right? What do you do with him? I think The Miz would make sense as an opponent once the stuff with Rollins and Ambrose runs its course, and maybe even you put the Intercontinental title on the guy. Although the last time they put the Intercontinental title on a guy without a lot of experience, didn't work so well, but I think in the end, The Rock certainly made the most of all the hate that he got from people. Maybe that's the way you turn Jordan heel. Too much too soon. Kurt's son. People start to resent him for it. The crowd turns on him. He turns on the crowd. You can go any number of ways with this. So, again, I would just caution people. It is incredibly stupid. But, it could still turn out to be a blessing for this guy who otherwise wasn't doing a lot on TV. I can't even say that he was stuck in the mid-card. Him and Gable just were not on television. It's like they disappeared, they vanished, and maybe they vanished because they knew that this was the payoff to the storyline and they wanted to keep him out of the public eye. But even before that, American Alpha was a dud on SmackDown, not because they're a shitty team, but because whatever ideas they may have had for them were shitty, and they just didn't know how to use them. Now he's going to have the spotlight on him. It's up to him to make the most of it. What I do know is, as I said earlier, it's yet another tag team purged from the roster. Golden Truth, Enzo and Cass, now American Alpha, the Hype Bros soon. Not a good time for tag teams right now in WWE. But with Jordan, I said to somebody on Twitter, somebody said, their theory is that Kurt Angle could not get cleared, and so the plan is to use Jordan as his surrogate in matches. Not only do I not believe that, but like I said a moment ago, I do think Kurt's going to wrestle again, and it will be against Jordan in Mania. So as far as that goes, I'll just put that out there now. That's my early prediction on that. The Jordan stuff dovetails nicely, though, into something else I wanted to talk about, and that is the state of the brand split 2.0, now that we're exactly 1 year into it. It was July of last year that they had the draft, and they split the brands, and they had, you know, they were preparing to crown two new champions, and the Universal title was going to be decided at SummerSlam. We're a year into this thing now, and I think, in fact, it was a year ago this week. And I was dead set against this move when they announced it, because I remember the first brand split and how they gave up on it. After those first few years, like 2002, 2003, slowly, every year, progressively, it got worse. And they got farther and farther away from the idea of what a brand split is really supposed to be about. I was not a fan of having two champions and having two titles. I did not want to see another brand split. And here we are, a year into it. I'm looking at some of the things that they've done just recently. They didn't bother on Monday night, by the way, to explain how Jason Jordan can simply jump from SmackDown to Raw just because he's Kurt Angle's son. They didn't even bother to explain that. AJ Styles, he beat Kevin Owens to win the U.S. title, a house show at Madison Square Garden, at a Raw house show. A SmackDown match with a SmackDown championship. And I get, oh, you know, it's a special attraction. But still, you know, holding true to this notion of a true brand split is clearly not a priority for them. John Cena, the free agent. I mean, I can go on and on. So already a year in, the lines are being blurred, right? In this so-called brand split. My two main concerns in bringing this thing back last year were splitting the titles and rendering the top belts even more meaningless, which is exactly what's happened, by the way, especially with the WWE title. And taking a Raw show, and this was my biggest gripe of all, taking a Raw show that was already an hour too long and splitting the roster in half. So now you're going from trying to fill 3 hours every single week with half as many guys to choose from. To me, it screamed insanity. And I think my concerns have been borne out. Because even in recent weeks, when you can maybe make the argument that Raw's been a little bit better, or at least it hasn't been as bad as it was maybe a month or two or three, by and large, this last year or so of Raw has been pretty shitty. This has not been one of the best years of Monday Night Raw. Some people would say it might be the worst. I don't know that I would go that far, because there's been some pretty dark periods of Raw over the years, going back even to the 90s. But this has not been one of the best years of Monday Night Raw. I am in no rush to go back on the WWE Network or jump on YouTube or on my DVR, although I don't have any episodes left on my DVR. I immediately delete them. But I'm in no position here where I'm interested in going and hey, I'm going to go watch that Raw show from February. Let's go back and watch some Monday Night Raws from December of 2016 or from April of 2017. That will never happen. I will never do that. I'd be more inclined to go back and watch a Raw from 2001 or 1998. So, to me, my fear of having a 3-hour show and cutting the roster in half was justified. Because what you see every week is, you know, they struggle many times to fill the show with segments that have some meaning and some purpose. And so what you're left with, especially in that third hour, because they don't always do a good job of spreading things out, it just feels like they're killing time. And that, to me, is the biggest insult to your audience. If the audience is watching this and the audience thinks, these guys are just killing time. They're just killing time to get to the main event. They're killing time to get to this or that. And you expect people to sit there for 3 hours and follow all the different storylines. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. I mean, no wonder that the Raw audience is down. I forgot the percentage, but it's unbelievable to look at the percentage of how the Raw audience has eroded over the years. It's stunning. I mean, you don't have to listen to people like me. Oh, Raw is, you know, terrible and this is bad and that's bad. Just look at the numbers. Just look at the numbers. Now we have more pay-per-views because we have single-brand pay-per-views every single month. You have a show like a Battleground. Battleground is a useless show. There should be no Battleground tonight. But yet, there's a SmackDown pay-per-view. And by the way, thinking back to the first brand split, what was the one thing really that suffered more than anything else? It was those SmackDown brand shows. Because SmackDown was always, save for maybe like a period of 2 years there in 02, 03, SmackDown was always kind of the redheaded stepchild. It was never given the same sort of priority that Raw was. It just never was. The quality of the show for a couple of years there was far better than Raw. But in terms of the priority the show was given, it was always number two. And so it was treated like a number two show. You look at some of the cards for those SmackDown brand-only pay-per-views back in, like, I don't know, 04, 05, and it's... And that was back when people had to pay 50 or 60 bucks. You didn't have the network where you basically can just watch them for free. I cannot imagine paying $50 to watch this Battleground show tonight. I can't imagine many of you would be doing that either. So we have all these pay-per-views now, many of which are just not necessary. You know, they have a SmackDown pay-per-view in Philadelphia tonight. Now, Philadelphia is one of WWE's biggest markets. They can't even sell out. The arena tonight had to discount some of the tickets that are still available. So as of a few days ago, you know, I wrote this down. As of a few days ago, a $125 ticket was marked down to $75. A $55 ticket for tonight was marked down to $25 because they're trying to get people into the building. They can't even sell out in a market like Philly. Here's another point. It's been a year. There's been no real trading between the two GMs or the two commissioners. There's been no fighting between them over new call-ups from NXT. Guys just show up. They just show up. There's no creativity or thought seemingly put behind any of it. They just sort of do things. They're like, the Joker in The Dark Knight. I just do things. Look at the Superstar Shakeup from April, which really did a number on SmackDown, by the way. SmackDown still hasn't recovered from the shakeup. I think it was Marco in our Facebook group who put it best when he said, the draft was beneficial to SmackDown, the shakeup was beneficial to Raw. I think that's an accurate statement. But I also think this whole brand split, when you really look at what it's done to the tag team division, even the women's division, I think would be stronger without this split. Or maybe just having them all on one brand. But the tag team division in particular, I think, has really suffered as a result. You look at the cruiserweights. I was a big fan of the Cruiserweight Classic last year. I thought it was a tremendous piece of business. And I was excited to see the cruiserweights back. It looked like they were really going to put some muscle behind this. And they were really, I mean, if it was anything like the Cruiserweight Classic, I was all in. And then it turned out to be the exact opposite. It turned out to be probably, let's be honest here, Vince McMahon's vision of what the cruiserweight division should be. or the people in the back of the writers or whoever, their vision of what they thought Vince McMahon would want the cruiserweight division to be. And I know it wasn't ever going to be able to be exactly what that tournament was like. Plus, it was a Full Sail. It's a smaller crowd, a smarkier crowd, whatever. And this is more of a mainstream crowd, and you have people coming to Raw and SmackDown who are not familiar with a lot of these guys. You know, and they did try running some video packages to get us familiar with people like, Cedric Alexander and TJ Perkins and guys like that, but they didn't do enough of that. They tried to make the Cruiserweight division fit in with what, you know, Vince McMahon's vision of the product is, right? They tried to sort of mainstream it in a way, and that's exactly what they should not have done. They had guys tone down their style, do more rest holds, tell more stories. You could tell stories without doing all the rest holds and all. I mean, my God, if you have Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens out there, and Kevin Owens has Roman Reigns in a chin lock and he won't let go, or a headlock, right? I guess he does the headlock. I mean, that's still a boring spot no matter what. Nobody likes a rest hold spot, although Owens at least tries to make them interesting. But it's one thing to see guys like that doing rest holds in the ring, two big guys. If you have a guy like a TJ Perkins and a guy like a Mustafa Ali, nobody is paying money to see Mustafa Ali out there doing a friggin' headlock. Nobody is paying money to see Brian Kendrick out there doing rest holds and slowing it down in the ring with Grand Metalik. And by the way, where the hell is Grand Metalik? Is this guy even in the company anymore? Where the hell has he been? I heard all these stories about how great Grand Metalik is. He's the best of all the cruiserweights that they brought in. Wait until you see this guy. And I saw him in the Classic and he was great. And then, poof, just vanished. Nowhere to be found. At least not on Raw. Maybe he's on like Main Event or something. But so that's another mystery that I haven't quite figured out yet. But the cruiserweights to me have been largely a failure. Now, it has been a big positive for someone like Neville. I'm a really big fan of what they've done with Neville. Neville, there's been a complete turnaround with this guy and what they were doing with him before, and he had the injury, and he fell on some tough times. Then he went heel. He developed this whole new persona. He's the king of the cruiserweights. He's the head cheese in that division. He's got a belt. He's in a good place right now, even though I still feel like he should be allowed to compete outside of the division. I can understand as long as he's the champion, you don't want to do that, I guess, because if you start putting him in matches against the other guys on the roster and they beat him, that doesn't exactly look good if you have them beating the Cruiserweight champion, so I get that. But Neville is far better than just being relegated to the Cruiserweight division for the rest of his career. I hope they realize that, and I hope in due time they allow him to sort of branch out a little bit more and wrestle guys like Seth Rollins and Finn Balor and people like that. So it has had some benefit for some people, but largely the Cruiserweight division has been a colossal fail. Now, I don't want to make it sound like it's all doom and gloom. I'm trying to be fair here. There have been some positive moves. I mentioned Neville. Neville has been one of the people who has benefited from the brand split. AJ Styles, he was the face of SmackDown last year, had a nice run as the WWE champion that he may not have gotten without there being a brand split. The rise of Braun Strowman. Now, Braun Strowman's a big guy. He probably would have gotten a big push no matter what. But him being on the Raw brand and having the brand split like this has given them more of a chance, I think, to kind of feature him in more of a main event position. I don't know that that would have happened without the brand split. So he certainly has benefited. Jinder Mahal, I've not been a fan of this run as WWE champion, but he's doing the best he can with it. Jinder sure as hell would not be in this position were it not for the brand split. He's probably at the top of the list in terms of people who have benefited from this. Naomi, Alexa Bliss. Some people are getting opportunities that they probably would not have gotten had there been just one brand and one belt. It has turned SmackDown into more of an important show than it was a year ago. You guys know, most weeks I wouldn't even bother with SmackDown. A year, year and a half ago, forget about it. I couldn't be... Why? What was the point? Now, SmackDown, as its own standalone show, it is more important. And that was the primary goal of moving SmackDown Live and the whole brand split in the first place, was USA wanted, you know, WWE to take SmackDown more seriously. They wanted to make SmackDown more comparable to Raw in terms of viewership and in terms of relevance. And I think, to a large extent, they have succeeded. You know, where the Cruiserweights may have failed and 205 Live may be a failure in some ways, SmackDown has been a success. So when I look at the big picture here overall, I still can't sit here and tell you I'm a fan of this brand split. It's you know, I don't know. It's not something that I can look back on and say, you know what, I was wrong. I would totally have done a brand split. There were moves that had to be made. They made the move they felt they had to make with all the talent they had. But overall, I can't say it's been a big negative or a big positive. I just think overall, 1 year in, the brand split has been a mixed bag. It's a work in progress. It's a mixed bag. A year from now, I might be sitting here saying, here we are, just like the first brand split. You know, SmackDown has slid backwards and they're not taking it seriously anymore and they need to end it. Or maybe a year from now, I'll sit here and say, you know what? It took a little bit of time, but I was wrong. This was the right move to make. I can't sit here now and tell you that, though. It's been a mixed bag. Now, also, today, July 23rd, marks 5 years to the day of Raw 1000, which is when Raw moved permanently to 3 hours every week. This is the five-year anniversary of Raw moving to 3 hours every single week. This, I can tell you pretty declaratively, is one of the worst moves that this company has ever made. And I understand that that third hour has netted them probably millions of dollars. So how could I sit here and say that? They've made millions. Because what they've done is they have begun the process, and it's only gotten worse year after year, of cannibalizing their audience. There are more and more people who are tuning out of Raw. Well, they're tuning out of Raw for a lot of reasons. They're just bored by what they're seeing. They think the product is shit. Everybody has their own reason for why they don't watch Raw. But I hear from, you know, a lot of people, for the most part, it's just too much. It's too long. They can't sit through a three-hour show. 2 hours they can tolerate. 3 hours they feel like, you know what, I can't give the show that much time. And so I'll just go on YouTube and I'll cherry pick some clips. And that's what more, and some people just aren't even watching at all. They're just listening to podcasts to keep up with what's going on. So 5 years into the 3 hour move, the move to 3 hours permanently, I think that it has sped up the erosion that had already started of their audience. There's no indication that it has in any way grown their audience, that it's been a positive move in that respect. All it's done is chase people away. And it has made this show more of a chore to sit through. It has made this show feel many times like all they're trying to do is just kill time and get through the night. And yeah, you could say that Raw going to 3 hours is good for people like Curtis Axel and Bo Dallas, who probably would not have been on Raw were there not an extra hour like there is. But that's up to WWE to figure out how to integrate those guys into the show. You can't tell me that, well, Curtis Axel and Bo Dallas, they can't be on Raw because Raw's only 2 hours. We can't put them on the show. Fuck that. Of course you can. Use your brain and come up with a way to use these guys. How many years have I said, why is Bo Dallas not with Bray Wyatt? Look at Bray Wyatt right now. Holy shit. You don't think Bray Wyatt wouldn't benefit from having somebody like a lackey, like a Bo Dallas with him? And trying to reform some kind of new Wyatt family faction? The guy has talent. I want to like this guy. But they have made it almost impossible. So a guy like Bo Dallas now, great. He's part of Miz's entourage. They're finally doing something with him. Great. Great. But for years, they did nothing. And, you know, I don't want to hear this nonsense that, well, you know, guys like this wouldn't have been on Raw were it not for, you know, 3 hours. They could have very easily been on Raw. You can't blame that. All you got to do is come up with ideas for these guys to just work them into the show. You know, he could have been with Bray years ago. Curtis Axel for a while was getting a push. They even put the Intercontinental title on him. And then they jumped ship. Something happened, or they came to some kind of realization that this guy just isn't good. I don't know what it was, but he disappeared awfully quick. That whole Heyman family, Heyman guy expansion didn't work out too well. Not for Axel, not for Cesaro. Which is why we don't see Heyman guys anymore. Because if they don't know how to do it, they shouldn't do it. Heyman and Brock. That's it. That's all you need. As far as Paul goes. That's his guy. They clearly don't know how to do a faction of people led by Paul Heyman. So why do it? But again, that's about the only thing I could point to that you could potentially argue where 3 hours becomes something that is beneficial. That guys underneath, who would otherwise be sitting and catering, eating chicken in the back, are now on TV because you have the extra hour. But what if you're not, you know, what are you doing with the extra hour? Are you making the extra hour that interesting and that exciting and must-see television? Are you really getting all these new guys over? You're putting them on TV, that doesn't mean that they're actually succeeding and getting over. Up until recently, Bo Dallas was coming to the ring with a giant sign, you know, wearing a singlet, doing jobs on TV every week until they finally found a role for him. That's up to them. That's up to Vince and the team that they put together there to come up with, you know, creative roles for these people. But if you're not a priority for them, you're not a priority. I don't care if the show is 4 hours long or 6 hours long. And by the way, I fully expect that if I'm still doing this podcast 5 years from now, I'll be sitting here saying, man, you know, 6 hours is just too long. They've got to go back to five. They have to roll Raw back to 5 hours. You know we're going to be having this conversation years from now, right? Because the show is only going to get bigger. It's only going to expand even more. So anyway, yeah, unlike the brand split, which is a mixed bag, I have no problem sitting here and telling you that this move to 3 hours, 5 years in now, was a horrible decision. I don't care how much money they've made off that third hour. They've done that, they've made that money at the expense of the product overall. I think we all knew where this was going, and that's exactly what's happened here. I mean, are any of us really surprised at the state of the show? 5 years in, are we really surprised? I'm not. NXT this past week, I'm not even going to play the music. I don't have a lot to say about NXT, so we'll kind of buzz through this here. But the card for the Brooklyn Takeover show has become a lot clearer after this week's show. We had Ember Moon beating Ruby Riott in the opening match, had a pretty good match. Clearly setting up Ember Moon as Asuka's challenger at Takeover. Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. If there's one match that you should watch from this show, and the main event was good, but this is the match I would go back and watch. I find myself, when I watch Oney Lorcan matches, having more fun watching his matches than I do almost anybody else these days in NXT. There's just something about this guy and his style. Maybe the fact that he actually literally goes in there and beats the crap out of people. I think the last couple of matches he's had, people have come up bloody. First today with Tommy, and now Danny Burch, who got popped right in the face. He was absolutely battered by like three or four open hand slaps at the end of this match and came up bloody. So I don't know if he broke anything or just busted up his nose. But it was a lot of fun watching. These two guys come off as like these old school sort of European brawlers. I don't know, Birch especially. But Oney beat him with a rolling half crab. If I remember correctly, I think Birch may have come off the top rope and Lorcan did a pretty impressive roll through into a Lance Storm-esque single leg crab and surprisingly got the tap out. I didn't expect that. So Oney Lorcan, I should say, with a rare submission win for himself. And when the match was over, they both agreed to one more match. I thought they were going to have the match right then and there, but I guess either on TV this week or sometime in the next few weeks, they're going to have another match. Sign me up. I love watching these two guys together. Main event was Drew McIntyre and Killian Dane of Sanity to determine a new number one contender for Bobby Roode's NXT Championship at TakeOver. Like I said before, these guys went in there and had a really good match. Dane went for the Ulster Plantation, but Drew escaped. He went for the Future Shock DDT. Dane backdropped him and hit a perfect plex from the top rope. Drew kicked out. Finally hit the Future Shock, but Dane kicked out at one. Very Japanese-esque there. Kicked out at one. McIntyre hit him with two Claymore kicks and finally got the pin. So, to no one's surprise, Drew McIntyre will challenge Bobby Roode at TakeOver for the NXT Championship. And I maintain, you know, we still have several weeks before then. We'll see how they build this thing up. But I would not take that title yet off Bobby Roode. I know it's inevitable that it's going to go to McIntyre, and I'm sure he'll do well with it, but I'm not ready to see Roode's run end, and I think it would be a mistake to take the championship off him in the first match, because you know they're going to have a rematch. They may end up having three matches. I wouldn't take the title off him just yet. Machinima is hosting an event called Body Count Fighting this Thursday, July 27th. Machinima covers video games and, in this case, fighting games. They're giving the show a bit of a pro wrestling flair with players cutting promos, and they're going to have video packages, entrances, and the whole nine yards. Their first event is up on YouTube right now. I watched part of it. It's pretty unique. The second one will be a combination of Street Fighter, Injustice 2, and Tekken 7 matches where players compete for bragging rights and championship belts in their respective games. They will begin streaming live on YouTube and Twitch starting at 9 p.m. Eastern this Thursday night, the 27th, from Machinima Studios in Burbank. So check them out. Talk about Impact. I don't really have a whole lot nice to say about Impact this week. I have some news, so we'll just get right into it here. First of all, their champion, the GFW champion himself, Alberto El Patron, is no longer under investigation in that Orlando Airport incident with Paige, which means his non-suspension is likely to be over any day now, I would assume. It doesn't make him any less of a psycho, the way he's been behaving these last several months, but since I did talk about this story a few weeks ago and it looked like he was possibly going to be charged with a crime, I did want to mention that he is, in fact, no longer the target of any investigation. Meanwhile, on the other hand, it looks like Paige may end up being the one charged in that incident with domestic assault. And if that happens, I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but I believe that means immediate termination from her WWE contract if she were to be charged with an actual crime with domestic battery. I believe by the letter of the policy in WWE, that would result in termination. And what that would then mean for the movie that you know WWE's film studio and The Rock have been working on about Paige and her family, what it means for the movie, I have no idea. The movie obviously is not the main concern right now. The main concern right now is Paige. This whole thing is a gigantic mess. And I'll tell you something. That photo that I saw yesterday circulating, I saw it last night. It's her posing. I don't know if it's from last week or the last few days or exactly when it's from. But it's her posing with Alberto and a few other people. It looks like possibly members of Alberto's family. To say that she looks unhealthy in that photo would be the understatement of the century. She's got bones sticking out of her chest like a refugee in some third world country in the middle of a famine. She looks like Gollum from Lord of the Rings in that photo. For the love of God, get that woman some help. Magnus is no longer with Global Force Wrestling. He had been the GFW champion. I guess he was on a handshake deal with the company to come in and to properly drop the championship. They presented him with a contract offer. I don't know if they lowballed him. I don't know if he was displeased with some of the terms of the contract, but he turned it down. And so Magnus now is a free agent, and that's interesting because his wife obviously works for WWE. They're not doing anything with her, but she's back with the company. And I was always amazed that there never seemed to be any real interest from WWE in Magnus because, as a wrestler, he's not any great shakes. It's not like he... Look, they have a lot of talented wrestlers in the company. Magnus isn't going to come in and blow people's, knock people's socks off by his great matches or anything like that. But his look, he's very articulate. There's just things about him who I think would make him successful and would bode well for him in a company like WWE. And I think he'd be a good spokesperson for the company in a lot of ways, a good representative for them. And he's a capable wrestler. You can find a spot for him. And there just never seemed to be... And you never really read about there being a whole lot of interest from the WWE side in Magnus. Now that he's a free agent, WWE seems to be signing everybody under the sun, and the fact that his wife works for the company, we'll see if that changes now. We'll see if there's any rumors and talks suddenly of Magnus possibly coming either to NXT or the main roster, because I do think that he is somebody who would probably be successful in that company. One last item here on Global Force. This Jeff Jarrett is quite the character. And this came from Sports Illustrated. So Sports Illustrated has sort of a wrestling column that they have. And there was it was a very brief note. It was a very brief note. And this might have been mentioned in The Observer as well, but I first read this in Sports Illustrated on the website, that GFW talent contracts, the wording in the contracts, has changed recently. And all Global Force contracts, I shouldn't say all, I mean, I don't know how it might be for some of the top guys there, but talent contracts in that company now stipulate that 100% of all merchandise sold, this is specifically merchandise that is created and marketed by Global Force, so I have to just mention that, but 100% of all of their merch for the talent in their company goes to the company. And I've seen some people have divided opinions about this. Some people say, well, that's perfectly fair because these guys are allowed to have their own stores on pro wrestling tees and they can make their own merch. Nobody's denying that. You know, nobody's denying that. For example, it also came out that Global Force is asking for 10% of any independent bookings that these talents are able to go out and get on their own. Most companies like WWE would not even let them go out and get independent bookings. But here's the difference. If you sign with WWE, you should not have to look for independent bookings because you should be making a good living working for WWE without having to go out and work elsewhere. Here, I don't know what some of these guys are getting paid. Okay, some I'm sure are getting paid better than others. And it's nice that they're allowed to go out and get independent bookings, and I guess Global Force taking 10% of that, I mean, I think that's the way I think it's worked for a while. I don't think that's really any different. I don't see that as being overly unfair, but the merchandise thing jumped out at me because that's quite a high percentage. 100%. You can't really go any higher than that. And I get that these guys are allowed to go sell their own merch if they have any. But again, if I'm working for Global Force, right, and I'm on their television and they're marketing me, and let's say I have a catchphrase that I use and Global Force makes a shirt for me, with my catchphrase on there, they're going to turn around and tell me that they take 100% of the money made off that shirt? Get the fuck out of here. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? But you know what? These guys are signing the contracts. So if they have no problem signing the contracts, then hey, what's there to be upset about? You signed the contract, you knew what you were getting yourself into. But I was amazed when I saw, I mean, I've heard of like 80%, 90%, 100% of the merch sold through GFW all goes to the company. Amazing. Amazing. Lucha Underground. Let's talk about Lucha Underground real quick here. This was the episode titled Fade to Black. More Cueto Cup matches as the tournament rolls on here on the... Oh God, I say rolls on. Now I'm using WWE verbiage. They call him Cage, was in the opening match. He lost to Pindar of the Lizard Tribe when Cage refused to take off his Nintendo Power Glove. That gives him all of his mystical, magical powers. And he punched the referee in the face. Punched the ref right in the face, knocked him out. Ref woke up, DQ'd him. So then after the match, Cage picks up the referee and gives him a brain buster. If this were any other wrestling company, he would be fined and suspended. I suspect that Dario Cueto probably saw this and actually was impressed by what Cage did here. Dante Fox and Son of Havoc had a really good match here in the Cueto Cup. Havoc was attacked before the match by Son of Madness, actually hit him with a chain, but he was bound and determined, Havoc was, to wrestle this match and not forfeit, so the match happened, and it was pretty damn good. Now, there was a point in the match where Son of Havoc gave Dante Fox basically an attitude adjustment off the apron to the arena floor. That had to suck. That was a really... that probably was not a fun bump for him to take. In the end, though, Dante was able to pick up the win with the Foxcatcher. So Dante Fox advances. Dante Fox, a very talented man. If you've not seen AR Fox in the past, you should definitely check out his work. Very talented guy. There was a scene in the locker room in the back with the Worldwide Underground introducing PJ Black, who was about to go out for the main event against Prince Puma. They introduced him to this some random white dude in a suit named Benjamin Cook. I guess they brought this guy in to be their new representative. I guess, out in Hollywood and try to get opportunities for them and whatnot. And I've never seen this guy before. I don't know if he's someone who works behind the scenes or he's a writer and they just gave him this role. We used to see that a lot. Actually, the head writer for Lucha Underground is Chris DeJoseph, and he would pop up all the time on WWE television, mostly as Big Dick Johnson. But, you know, it was not unheard of for them to take writers and people in those roles and put them out on TV in cameo roles. Of course, Tommaso Ciampa. Tommaso Ciampa was once on SmackDown back in like 2005. Bet a lot of people don't know that. He was on television once as a lawyer. I believe he got beat up by The Undertaker, if I'm not mistaken. He looked very different than he does now. You got to actually go back and find an old photo of what he looked like during that segment. He had hair. The hair, the glasses, looked completely different. Now he looks like a psycho killer. Back then, he looked like a Boy Scout. Actually, he looked more like a douchebag, the way he was all dressed up. He looked like some preppy schmuck. Anyway, they're introducing, hey, PJ, come over here. We want to introduce you to Benjamin Cook, and he's given all these ideas about what he can do for them and everything, and he's just blathering on. So anyway, PJ Black and Prince Puma in the main event, a Cueto Cup match. This was an excellent match. Awesome main event. It makes me sad that PJ obviously has a death wish and keeps getting injured in all these base jumping accidents. Remember the most recent one? He broke, I think, both of his legs. He lost a finger. Otherwise, I think this guy could really be something. I also find it funny that he used the move in this match that apparently he calls the wellness policy, or at least that's what Matt Stryker referred to it as. Puma won in the end with the 630 senton to advance, but you really should find this match. Track it down if you have not seen it and watch it. It is that good. The closing scene of the show was Dario in his office. He was answering a call on his red telephone. And in comes PJ Black after his loss. And Dario just goes, oh, he's here now. And he quickly hangs up the phone. And Dario says, you know, this Benjamin Cook guy has already called me 17 times to talk about the fact that you deserve a rematch. And PJ was taken aback by this. He's like, the match just ended only a couple of minutes ago. And then as soon as he said that, the phone rang again. And Dario ripped the phone jack out of the wall so it would stop ringing. And he said, look, you're going to have a chance to redeem yourself because next week I've booked you in a match against Rey Mysterio. And PJ looked very pleased by this. He left the office, and as soon as he walks out, Dario's cell phone begins going off, and he pulls it out of his jacket pocket, and it says, Benjamin Cook on the phone. I'm impressed by the fact that not only does he have this guy's number in his cell phone, even though we were just introduced to him, he has him in his list of contacts. He actually came up as Benjamin Cook. I thought that was very impressive. So he sees that it's Cook and he just throws the cell phone in the garbage can. Because, you know, that's a lot easier than just silencing the phone. Let's just take our cell phone and throw it in the garbage can. And that's how the show ended. So that was Lucha Underground this week. Let's talk about the G1 climax. This is what I've been waiting for. Forget all this other nonsense with illegitimate kids and all this other bullshit. Let's get down to brass tacks here. Let's talk about the G1. This is the 27th annual G1 for New Japan Pro Wrestling. I've been doing my best to keep up with as much of the G1 as I can so far. It's been about, I think we're about 4 or 5 nights in now. I don't have time to watch all of it, so these are just my thoughts on some of the matches that I've seen over the first few days. This is not a formal review. You can watch all of the G1 shows if you've missed them on New Japan World, and some of them will have English commentary from Kevin Kelly and Don Callis. Not all of them. Not all of them will have English commentary going forward. Honestly, though, I don't mind the Japanese commentary at all. So I have no problem watching the show with or without the English commentary. Because even though I don't understand what they're saying, it's still a lot of fun to listen to them. If you are not familiar with the G1, every summer, New Japan holds a round-robin tournament with an A block and a B block. Everyone in the A block wrestles each other once. Everybody in the B block wrestles each other once. They have a point system to determine the final winner from each block. It's the person with the most number of points. You get 2 points for a win, 1 point for a draw, no points for a loss. Okay, those are the basic rules. If two guys in the same block are tied in the end with the same number of points, I don't know what happens, actually. I should know this. I don't know what happens if there is a tie. That's actually a really good question. I'll have to find out. But in any event, the tournament runs for an entire month, 4 straight weeks of the G1. And the winner from each block will then meet each other in the finals. The winner of the G1 then gets an IWGP Championship match at Wrestle Kingdom on January 4th. So you can look at it as sort of their version of the Royal Rumble winner going on to WrestleMania. Although it's almost an insult to compare the G1 to the Royal Rumble. I mean, that's like, you know, that's like comparing a diamond ring to a blow pop. Night one, we had Zack Sabre Jr. against Hiroshi Tanahashi. Tanahashi, of course, has the torn bicep that he's been wrestling on, and or wrestling with, I should say. And so the story of this match was Sabre, who's just an absolute, just a maniacal individual when it comes to targeting body parts and joint manipulation. He was making Tanahashi suffer, working that arm over in this match. And, you know, Tanahashi went for the sling blade and Sabre grabbed onto his arm. And anyway, he in the end, Sabre wins his very first G1. This is Zack Sabre Jr.'s very first G1. And he gets the submission win over the Intercontinental Champion, Hiroshi Tanahashi. It's hard for me even to describe the kind of submission hold that he put Tanahashi in. He was, you know, hyperextending the arms, and Tanahashi is just in so much pain. He's starting to bend the fingers and everything, and I was in pain just watching this. And it is something I enjoy watching when it comes to Zack Sabre matches. If I'm watching somebody, and they're supposed to be hurting or torturing somebody in the ring, and I'm supposed to buy into it, and it's making me uncomfortable, then the guy's doing his job. And that's what he did here, and Tanahashi took as much as he could until he couldn't, and he submitted. And I think that's an important point to make, because I think people compare John Cena a lot to Tanahashi, or Tanahashi to John Cena, in that they've been kind of the face of their respective companies for so long. And it was a match that people sometimes ask me about, one day, could we see Tanahashi against John Cena? And I said, no. But, people compare the two a lot. And one of the biggest differences is that John Cena, because his whole character is never give up, never give up. They have it in their head, Vince McMahon has it in his head, that John Cena can literally never give up. You cannot have him ever, ever submit. We've never even seen him pass out. He's never lost a match by submission since he became the WWE champion. I know he tapped out to Kurt Angle's ankle lock back in like 03, 04, but in the kind of more modern day incarnation of Cena going back 10 or 12 years, he's never submitted. And I think that's so stupid because, if you're so worried about the kids or the message that it sends to the kids, it's okay every now and then to tap out. And I'm like imagining John Cena in the same situation. If let's say he's in the ring with someone like Sabre and he's got an injury and they're exploiting the injury and they're bending the arms and they're bending the fingers, what would happen in the end is John Cena would inevitably just find a way to work his way out of it. Right, and then hit the AA and probably get the win. But I like this. I like the fact that a guy like Tanahashi can go in there, and even Tanahashi, even the great Hiroshi Tanahashi, when the situation calls for it, will tap out. Because I know that's something we will never, ever see from John Cena in WWE. Even a guy like Randy Orton. I'm trying to imagine Randy Orton tapping out, like losing a match by tap out to someone, and I can't see it. It's so predictable in WWE. I like it when they do stuff like that here in New Japan. So we had Kota Ibushi against Tetsuya Naito. This was a great match. I love this match. They were working over the neck, Naito was, of Ibushi. And I'll tell you something, for a guy that had neck surgery, pretty major neck surgery from what I understand, which is what Ibushi had, and they even talked about it on commentary during the Cruiserweight Classic, this guy sure does like to take a lot of bumps on his neck. I mean, I thought he was dead after that burning hammer that Kendrick gave him in the Cruiserweight Classic. But here he is taking bumps on his neck, and it's ugh. So Naito goes for the Destino, which is his big move. Ibushi grabs him, literally throws him, launches him like a lawn dart into the turnbuckle. And Ibushi gave Naito a pile driver from the middle rope. But he kicked out. That I didn't like. You're going to pile drive somebody off the middle rope. You're going to pile drive somebody off the top rope. I'm sorry. That has to be the finish. Maybe it's just me. But he kicked out. Naito finally did hit the Destino. Ibushi kicked out. Naito gave him a second one. And he made the cover and finally got the win after that. Just an absolutely fantastic match. Kota Ibushi is a madman. The bumps he takes, the things he does. Naito was awesome too, obviously. But the two of them just worked very well together. And to think that this was only night one. They had a match like this on the very first night of the G1. It's like the G1. There's nothing like the G1. I mean, if you're just looking for pure quality when it comes to you know, wrestling, if that's what you look for in your pro wrestling, this is all you need. I mean, I don't even think you need to really be that big of a New Japan fan to be able to watch this and just appreciate. And there's a lot of guys, you know, you'll recognize some of the names in the G1. It's not all Japanese stars. You know, they bring in stars from all over the world, from Japan, from the UK, from the US. You know, I just saw Michael Elgin wrestle Okada the other night. It's fantastic. And it's my regret is that I have not followed along in the past as closely as I am this time. And I'm seeing, you know, exactly what I missed out on. And I'm kind of kicking myself for it. But it's been a blast so far. So the match, that match was match of the year caliber stuff. I mean, that's how good it was. The thing about Ibushi, I want to make one more point about him before I move on to night two. It's almost horrifying for me to think that this guy could have been stuck in cruiserweight hell in WWE, just wrestling Brian Kendrick over stolen passports in 5-minute matches. I mean, you know, yes, Ibushi and Neville, which is the match that I pitched for WrestleMania this year, would have been unbelievable, right? But then what? Then what? Like the week-to-week television, do I trust WWE? Do I trust Vince McMahon to take somebody like a Kota Ibushi, who I'm convinced would be stuck in the cruiserweight division, and actually do right by this guy and use him in a way that he should be used? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's scary to think about. When you look at what they've done with some of the guys in that cruiserweight division and the talent that they have and what they're doing with a lot of them, I mean, they had enough sense not to take somebody like a Finn Balor and put him in the cruiserweight division because Balor is... You know, Balor's really good, and I know not everybody is a Balor fan, but he's better than the cruiserweight division, so thank God he's not stuck in there. Ibushi is the same thing, and if anything, Ibushi is even more talented. So the idea that he could have been stuck in this division, it's absolutely horrifying for me to think about, and thank God he had enough sense when they kept coming at him, we want you to sign a contract, we want you to sign a contract. This guy is not stupid. He might do a lot of stupid shit in the ring, but he's not a dumb guy. He knew. He's like, no thank you. You want to bring me in for a match here and there at Full Sail, that's fine, but I ain't signing a contract. He had the right idea. So we had night two of the G1. We had Okada against Toriano. Now, Toriano is more of a comedy character in New Japan, if you're not familiar with him. He's always out there with a copy, you know, his DVD. He's always hawking his DVD. He's a funny guy. Not a particularly, you know, he's not a guy that you watch New Japan to watch him have 5-star matches or anything like that, but he serves his role. So he had a match here with Okada. Okada is the IWGP champion. Both of them, by the way, are members of the Chaos faction. They are part of the same group. And yes, the champion is in the G1, and thank God for that, because that means we're going to get Okada Omega 3 coming up on August 12th, since they're both in the B block together. It has been, from what I understand, over 15 years since the reigning champion, in this case Okada, has won a G1. I don't think that changes this year, but stranger things have happened. Okada so far is on a tear in the G1, so he's got a chance. I just don't see him winning the whole thing. This was basically a comedy match, but I loved it. I thought this was very entertaining. And, you know, for a guy like Okada who's been killing himself all year, these matches, month after month after month, the abuse that this guy is taking, you know that this was like a night off for him, right? In there with a guy like Yano. I mean, this was a night off for him. So they're outside the ring. Okada comes charging in at Yano. Jado steps in. He steps in. He's like, no. Because Jado and Gedo are also members of Chaos. So Jado's telling him, don't do it. Meanwhile, Toriano sneaks up, shoves Jado into Okada, and then he gives low blows to both of them. So now they're writhing in pain. Gedo sees this. He low blows Yano as payback. So now everybody's been low-blowed. They both get back in the ring. They barely beat the 20 count. They hit 19, and they both dive in just in the nick of time. And actually, I thought in the final like 3 or 4 minutes here, they had a good back and forth, some good near falls. Okada locked in the red ink, which is basically an STF. And when was the last time he even won with the red ink? I can't think of the last match he won with that move. But you know what? It's good to get that thing over. It's good to get a move like that over every now and then when you don't normally win with it. In a match like this, he didn't have to hit the Rainmaker. He's going to hit the Rainmaker 5,000 times in this G1. He didn't need the Rainmaker to beat Yano. He beat him with the red ink. After the match was over, he helped Yano up to his feet. Okada's standing there. He does the Rainmaker pose. Yano does his pose next to Okada. The shot of the two of them together like that I thought was funny. This was fun. I enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun. Then we had Kenny Omega and Minoru Suzuki. Suzuki is one of the scariest men alive. I would shit myself if he ever stared at me the way that he stared at Omega here. I'd have to wear a diaper, an adult diaper. Omega could not even look him in the face. He would not make eye contact with him. He looked so terrified before the match started. This was really good. Not as good as Ibushi Naito from night one. Red Shoes took a big ref bump here. We had a lot of interference from Suzuki Gun, from Bullet Club. I wasn't really a fan of all the interference, but whatever. They brawled into the crowd. They hit each other with chairs. Somehow this wasn't a DQ. Because Suzuki is a brawler. That's what he does. And I think it was even Don Callis on commentary was saying, you know, he knew it would happen. And as soon as he sees Suzuki going after the chairs and everything, he's like, oh, why? What are you doing? Come on. So they're hitting each other with chairs. He worked over Omega's knee. That was kind of the story of the match. At one point, Omega did a one-legged moonsault off the middle rope, which was impressive. Two V-triggered knees, one-winged angel, and that was it. Kenny Omega wins. Kenny Omega, by the way, he won the G1 last year. That was his very first G1 ever, and he won. I think Kevin Kelly said he was the first foreigner. I think he might have been the first non-Japanese star ever to win the G1 last year. Will he repeat? Anything's possible. I just want to see Omega against Ibushi. I don't care if it's in the finals. I don't care if it's at Wrestle Kingdom next year. Omega's already teasing it in interviews. He's talking about how Kota left him high and dry last year to go in the, you know, the Cruiserweight Classic. And suddenly he's back with a spot in G1. So they're already planting the seeds for that match down the road. I almost feel the way about that the way I feel about Nakamura and AJ, where if they give us the match next month, I certainly won't mind it, and it's going to be fantastic, but I would rather they hold off. So, like, I kind of think Omega Ibushi could be a big, like, co-main event at Wrestle Kingdom, and I think Styles, and somebody asked me on Twitter the other day, they said, hey, as of today, as of right now, what do you want the WrestleMania 34 main event to be? What do you want that sort of big title match to be? If I, you know, could choose the WrestleMania main event for next year, right now, it's AJ and Nakamura for the WWE title. That would be the WrestleMania 34 main event. And I kind of feel that's the same way about Ibushi and Omega. So we'll see. It's definitely going to happen. It's just a matter of when. So, and I think if they do that match, by the way, I think Jim Cornette's head might explode. There are very few people not named Russo. That he has this violent hatred towards. And for whatever reason, Ibushi is one and Omega is one. And I'm going to actually talk about Cornette here in a little bit. We'll get back to him. I did not see any of Night 3 of the G1. I missed Night 3. I just didn't have the time. I did watch parts of Night 4, though. There was an excellent main event with Okada beating Michael Elgin with the Rainmaker, one of several that were used in that match. But the real story coming out of Night 4 was the brutal murder perpetrated by Bad Luck Fale of Bullet Club of a defenseless stuffed animal, an emotional support cat named Daryl that Hiromu Takahashi started carrying to the ring with him earlier this year. I think he lost the championship match and the guy went crazy. And he started taking the cat everywhere with him. He even made Daryl a member of the Los Ingobernables faction. He was a part of the family. And anyone who's ever had a pet knows what I'm talking about. Pets are members of the family. And what Fale did on this show was reprehensible. O.J. Simpson was in the news this week. He got paroled after serving time for a botched robbery. Okay, he once killed two people and got away with it. And even O.J. thought Fale went too far here. There was a tag team match. Fale was beating up Naito outside the ring. He looks over and he spots Daryl Takahashi. He grabs him. He quite literally rips him to shreds. His insides fly all over the place. People in the crowd are laughing at this. These are sick people. He disemboweled this poor cat. And so I would like to take a moment here. It's only fitting that we give Daryl a 10-bell salute to honor his sacrifice. He wasn't around for very long, but he left an impression on a lot of people. Granted, I had no idea that he even existed before this week, but he clearly touched many lives. He used up all nine of his, and so let us honor the memory of Daryl Takahashi. Fuck you, Fale. Just give me a minute. I'm sorry. Anyway, I'll have more G1 coverage next week. Hopefully not as somber as this week. This week's sad tweet goes to one James E. Cornette. He just could not help himself. I'd like to think that he at least believes in what he says when he spews all of his venom at guys like Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks, you know, for ruining the wrestling business, and it's not all just an act to get attention, which would be really lame. With Cornette, I feel like he does believe in the things that he says, but he's also a worker, right? I mean, he's been doing this for 30-some-odd years, so the best workers are always the most convincing ones, but Mr. Lariato on Twitter, which is a great account to follow, by the way, for Japanese wrestling gifs, posted a gif from the infamous match many years ago between Kota Ibushi and a blow-up doll, Yoshiko, or Yoshihiko. Forgot exactly. I keep thinking of Yoshiko, the idiot who beat the woman up, beat her so badly that she had to retire and have reconstructive surgery on her face and then ended up leaving wrestling. And then I think she's back now. She should have been blackballed forever. That witch. But in any event, Kota Ibushi wrestles the blow-up doll, and Dave Meltzer quote-tweeted the tweet and said about Ibushi, he said, "This man just set Sapporo's gate record. Some call this amazing talent, some call it killing the business. One does not compute." Basically inferring that Ibushi is not killing the wrestling business. In fact, he's doing just the opposite right now for New Japan. Well, Jim Cornette doesn't really agree with that point of view. He and Meltzer are friends. They probably follow each other on Twitter, which is why he saw the tweet in the first place. He sees it. He jumps in with this gem. This is what Jim Cornette tweeted in response to all of this. He said, "I don't really care if Adolf Hitler was an amazingly talented painter. He should get no compliments. These fucks, Omega and Ibushi, same thing." End quote. When you hate a wrestler so much that you feel the need to invoke Hitler as a comparison, I think it might be time to step away from Twitter for a while. And for the record, if he had made that comment, that same comparison about Vince Russo, and maybe he has, no, it's very possible that Cornette already has in some way compared Russo to Hitler in the past. If he did, much as I don't care for Russo, that would be just as stupid. And to his credit, Kenny Omega was very polite in his response to Cornette. Omega was pure class about the whole thing, which I think is a credit to him. But Cornette, it was just incredibly stupid thing for him to say. Let's get to your questions. If you have them, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Now, the first email here came to me on Tuesday from a gentleman named Vincent, or at least that's what he claims his name to be. I am withholding his last name, and I blocked out part of his email address when I posted this on Twitter and Facebook. Everybody said, you gotta read this letter on the show, and so I said, sure. He is very upset with me about things that I have said about Vince McMahon. Mind you, this email came from Vincent. Okay? I will now read this to you in its unedited form. I am reading this exactly as it is written, mistakes and all. Okay? Here we go. I have viewed and listened to many of your sound offs on YouTube. It is obvious to me that you are a Vince McMahon's hater. Do you think he gives a shit that people like you exist? You see, the problem with people like you is ignorance and unintelligence. And if I may interject here, it is unfortunate that he would send an email insulting my intelligence and then proceed to assassinate the English language like this, but nonetheless. Fools like you look at wrestling but don't understand what's behind it. You don't understand it is a business, and that is what powers wrestling. You don't understand that there are many facets of WWE of which wrestling is a part of. A faceless nobody like you think you can come out and insult Mr. McMahon. You remind me of the verse in the Bible where Job was blaming God for all of his woes. By the way, this is the first time that anybody has ever compared me to a Bible verse. He continues, so God said to him, on paraphrase, Job, where were you when I was creating the world? The poor Job immediately went down on his knees and repented. So I ask you, where were you when Mr. McMahon was building the WWE to where it is today? His defeat of Ted Turner's WCW, his creation of WrestleMania, his creating of the network, social media, film division, WWE's worldwide presence, just to mention a few. You see, this is why Mr. McMahon doesn't recognize or acknowledge people and websites like you. People like you are angry, not only because WWE does not acknowledge you, but also because you don't work for WWE. In closing, let me say this. If you have any common sense to know what it takes to run the WWE, the production, the commitments, the finance, the manpower, etc., you will realize how foolish you are and sound. You make a living talking about WWE. Oh, really? I make a living doing this. That's news to my accountant. And then you turn around and disrespected the man that made it all happen. You are benefiting from Mr. McMahon's sweat and blood, you hypocrite. If you don't like what the WWE is doing, why don't you go cover the independents where you belong? You criticize Alberto Del Rio, or whatever he calls himself now, for bad mounting WWE. And then you turn around and does the same thing he does. WWE don't need people like you, don't recognize people like you, and sure don't acknowledge people and websites like yours. So know your role and your place. Wow. He quoted The Rock there at the end. I bad-mounted WWE, according to Vincent here. I bad-mounted them. I wonder, does that make me...
I'm the Mountie. I'm handsome, I'm brave, I'm strong. I'm the Mountie. And I enforce the law. You can try to spell, or you can go to hell. The Mountie always gets McMahon.
I'm the Mountie, everyone. Oh, I'm such an asshole. Anyway, Jay from the UK. That was fun, actually. Jay from the UK. That rhymes. When you spoke about the idea that WWE thinks we have dementia. Well, according to Jinder Mahal, Vince McMahon thinks the fans, quote, have a short memory span. This was stated on Talk Is Jericho with Jinder as his guest in literally the first 30 seconds of the interview. Do you think that Vince has become poison to his own company and would be better off managing the business side and leaving the in-ring product to someone else? A 70-plus-year-old man could not possibly relate to a 22-year-old man like myself. You know, it's a hard thing to say because let's say Vince steps aside, who takes over, right? I guess Triple H. And that doesn't mean that everything is all of a sudden going to become, great again and it's going to make sense and everything's going to be all hunky-dory. I mean, just listen to the interview I did with Justin Roberts this week. And Justin Roberts was talking about Triple H and his experiences with him and how things might be the day comes what he runs the company. And it may not be what everybody thinks it's going to be. And Vince is still, you know, whatever you think about him, he is still a very successful businessman. He's still a very successful promoter. Has he become poison to his own product? Yes, in many ways he has. Does that mean he should step aside? You know, you have to have a plan in place. If he's going to step aside and kind of hand over, now you say the in-ring basically what Jay is saying is let Vince handle the business aspect and oversee the business side of things and let somebody else kind of oversee the creative process. I think that would be a fine idea because I think Jay hits on something important here. When you're talking about the creative process and the product that we see on TV and the storylines and stuff, Vince McMahon is 71 years old. He's 71 years old and he is still stuck in this old school. It's funny to me, like in a lot of ways, he's stuck in an old school wrestling mentality, but there's a lot of old school stuff that they could be doing that they're not doing. It's like all the really kind of ridiculous old school shit that they shouldn't be doing anymore. I just talked about SmackDown. Look at the top three heels on SmackDown right now. Jinder Mahal and Rusev and Kevin Owens. And how are they portrayed as like the evil foreign menaces, right? I mean, Kevin Owens to a lesser extent, but he is playing up the whole I'm from Canada and I'm the face of the U.S. But you got Rusev, the evil Bulgarian. You've got Jinder Mahal, the evil guy from India. He's going to take the title back to India. And he's playing off all these, you know, stereotypes and playing that up. And it's like, that's 1980s wrestling bullshit. That's 1970s wrestling bullshit. Why are we still doing this in 2017? Because you have a guy who's still living in the past and he's so outdated and he's thinking back to the way things used to be. Oh, we'll do this now. So yeah, in a lot of ways, he is poison to his own product. And I wish that there would be somebody younger and more sort of in tune with things that could take over in that role and let Vince handle the other stuff. I think that would be a fine idea, but you got to be careful what you wish for because who takes over, matters a lot. You can't just get rid of Vince and say, well, okay, now we have this open spot where everyone's sort of fending for themselves. You have to have somebody with a vision. And Vince McMahon's vision right now for what he wants this product to be, it's just, you know, it's not working. In a lot of ways, it's just not working. And so if there was somebody who brought to the table a fresher set of ideas and was a bit younger, I think that would help a lot. I really do. Francisco, why do you suppose WWE never really gave The Undertaker a proper send-off like a goodbye speech? Is it because his career is not totally over? He's not done. That's why. He's not done yet. Jalen from Ohio, if you had a podcast for any wrestling event, what would it be? For example, the Benoit tragedy or the first WrestleMania? I would say the Montreal Screwjob. I wish I was doing the sound off when the Screwjob happened because I could have gotten a good 6 months worth of content out of that one event. I mean, are you kidding me? You know how much material I would have had for this podcast had I been doing a show back then? I mean, WWE's gotten almost 20 years out of it. Speaking of the screw job, Brian from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And by the way, it is 2017. So we are going on the 20-year anniversary of that screw job. So if you don't think the WWE isn't going to mention that and play it up somehow, you're out of your mind. Get ready. It's coming. Speaking of the screw job, Brian from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was rereading about the Montreal screw job the other night and came across an alleged quote from the British Bulldog in the aftermath of the chaos. Allegedly, Owen, who was very upset about Brett being screwed, demanded to be let out of his contract, but was warned by Davey Boy to, quote, remember what happened to Bruiser Brody. Was this actually said by Davey Boy, and if so, was he alluding to the fact that Owen might have been killed if he indeed left the WWF? Well, that's just bullshit. I mean, that's ridiculous. Now, I read what Brian sent to me. It was a list of facts about Montreal. from some like message board forum, I think. And I don't think it was a case that Owen asked. So let me backtrack a little bit here, okay? Because this is jumping all over the place. Did Owen Hart ask to be released from his contract? Yes. Yes. Bulldog bought himself out of his own contract. I think Bulldog had to pay $150,000 of his own money to get out of his contract because he still had like 2 or 3 years left on it. He paid to get out of his own contract to go to WCW, which, as it turned out, led to his downfall because he got injured in WCW and it was a whole mess. And it led, I think, ultimately to him dying as young as he did. But Owen tried. Vince would not let him out of his contract. So that is true. I don't think that has to do with what you're talking about here, because from what I'm reading, it sounds like that comment, if Davey Boy made that comment, and I'm skeptical that he did, but it sounds like it would have been made that night that everything happened. So Vince comes to meet Brett in the locker room, and it says here, you know, Sergeant Slaughter and Jerry Briscoe tried to usher everybody out and kind of leave them alone in Brett's dressing room. Owen went to leave, and that's when Davey Boy allegedly said, "Remember Bruiser Brody." And look, I wasn't there, so who the hell knows, but that sounds like a situation where maybe he was worried about what Brett might do to Vince, not so much what Vince might have done to Brett in the state of mind that Brett was in. And then maybe I could say, I could see him saying to Owen, "Hey, whoa, don't leave. Remember Brody. Don't leave. Let's stay here in case shit goes down and we have to try to defuse the situation." And in fact, when things did kind of go to hell and Bulldog, I think, tried to pull, I don't know if it was a case where a fight broke out. Bulldog got physically involved. I think Shane McMahon tried to jump in and Bulldog pulled Shane away. And in doing so, Bulldog injured his knee. That's a fact. That's how Bulldog hurt his knee. He didn't have his knee brace on, and him trying to pull Shane out of the pile, I don't know if he tore something or he just sprained it or twisted it. So that sort of happened. But that would really be the only context I could see a comment like that making sense. Otherwise, I can't imagine he would have made a comment like that. But only if, let's say, Owen was leaving or went to go leave to give them their privacy or whatever, and Bulldog had enough sense to say, "Hey, shit might be going down here. Remember Brody, let's stick around." Maybe he could have said something like that in that context, but this is the first I'm hearing about this. Until you sent me this email, I had never heard that before. And so I am skeptical about that. Brody, by the way, you mentioned Bruiser Brody. Brody was stabbed to death 29 years ago this past week. 29 years ago. Maybe the single most deplorable thing to ever happen in wrestling outside of the Benoit stuff, which technically was not at a wrestling show. So the Brody thing might be the most deplorable thing to have ever happened in wrestling. I mean, look, the guy was stabbed and was left laying on the floor to bleed to death. And the piece of shit who stabbed him comes back and wrestles. It's sick. I don't care if Brody was difficult to work with. I'm sure Brody also was an asshole. There's a lot of stories about Bruiser Brody being an asshole. Bobby Heenan hated him. Bobby Heenan hated Bruiser Brody because he would go from territory to territory and take, and then he would bail on the promoters because he didn't trust promoters and probably had a good reason not to, you know, but that would hurt people in each territory, at least from the perspective, you know, from what Heenan saw. And I'm sure he's not the only one. So yeah, Bruiser Brody was no angel. He probably was very hard to work with and didn't want to do jobs and would pick up and just leave. And that probably put a lot of promoters and the people who worked there in a tough situation. But that's not an excuse to go stab the guy to death and let him bleed out. That whole situation is just sick. James from Brooklyn, New York. "I've been a wrestling fan for over 25 years. I want to know your thoughts on the main event of Survivor Series in 1993. The All-Americans against the Foreign Fanatics." We have the Foreign Fanatics on SmackDown these days. "I personally loved this match as I had become something of a Lex Luger fan at the time. However, many of my peers hated the fact that The Undertaker was used to replace Tatanka in that match. I liked Tatanka, but I thought bringing Undertaker in was a good move for an otherwise lousy pay-per-view. Plus, it helped set the stage for Undertaker's feud with Yokozuna. What are your thoughts on the match?" It was a match. I don't remember it being anything special. I actually watched that Survivor Series 93 show a few months ago. I was watching the Hearts against Shawn Michaels and the Knights. And then I watched this match. I remember Lex beating Borga at the end, Ludwig Borga, and celebrating with Santa Claus at the end of the show with snow, fake snow falling from the ceiling or cocaine or whatever it was. And they did the same thing with Bret Hart at the end of the pay-per-view the year before. Thankfully, that little tradition ended after those 2 years. I don't think Undertaker celebrating with Santa Claus at the end of Survivor Series in 94 would have gone over very well. But there was one moment from that match, the match that you're talking about, that I still remember to this day. It is one of my favorite images from Survivor Series ever in the history of that show. Yokozuna rolls out of the ring. Undertaker goes out after him. Yoko hits him in the gut, or kicks him in the gut, whatever it was, grabs Undertaker by the head, and rams him into the top of the ring steps. And they had a camera perfectly positioned. The camera was perfectly positioned. He rams Undertaker's head right into the top of the steel steps. Undertaker just whips his hair back, like shoots right back up, whips his hair back, rolls his eyes into the back of his head, and turns his head sideways like some kind of zombie cyborg. And the look of sheer terror on Yoko's face was just priceless. Undertaker gave him a death stare, and Yokozuna sold it with one look. I love that. You'll see that moment pop up in some like Undertaker video packages and stuff, like when they show his career from over the years. It's just a brief moment, but it was so awesome. And that's the one main thing I remember from that match. Was that moment between them outside the ring. We'll do one more here. Dylan from Billings, Montana. Buy or sell on the better performer pre-injury, Triple H in 2001 or Seth Rollins in 2015? Ooh, that's a good one. That is a good one. I got to go with Triple H. I have to buy Triple H and sell Rollins. I mean, Rollins is the more dynamic performer in the ring. He can fly around and do stuff that Triple H could never do. But I look at that. I've said this so many times that Triple H, at his best, as long of a career as he's had, I still maintain that Triple H, at his best, was pre-quad tear in 2000 into the beginning of 2001. That was the best incarnation of Triple H. That was the best of Triple H as an in-ring performer physically. And I was a fan of his work, especially in the year 2000 when it was him and The Rock basically carrying that company on their shoulders for most of the year until Austin came back. Triple H back then was awesome. He really matured into a main event performer. I didn't buy him as a main eventer until Foley put him over in the street fight at the Rumble. That's where I really first bought in to Triple H in a top spot. And he had just an incredible year, right through WrestleMania 17 and the match with The Undertaker, which I thought was better than I expected it to be, and into the two-man power trip, and then the leg gave way, and to me, he was never really the same after that. And he was still a good performer, but just was never the same. But back then, you know, he was such a great heel. He was a great heel. He could talk. I think he's a better talker than Rollins, even back then when Triple H maybe didn't have as much confidence as he does now on the microphone. I still think he was better, you know, at that point than Rollins was on the mic. So I look at overall, not just the in-ring, and I, you know, to me, I have to buy on Triple H and sell on Rollins. But, you know, with Rollins, it's interesting in that since Rollins came back, look, don't get me wrong, Rollins is in tremendous, he's in better shape than I am. I mean, he's in great shape. But you can even see it in Rollins. Like, physically, he doesn't quite look the same as he did before the knee injury. And I don't know if that's just he's put on some weight, if he's training a different way. He's a little bit bigger. And, you know, in the ring, I think he's pretty much come back just about to where he was. I still feel like he's not quite doing the same things in the ring he was before the injury, which would be understandable because he suffered a pretty catastrophic knee injury. And it being a knee injury, that in and of itself is probably going to slow you down. It might make you a little more skittish in terms of things that you do. But he's still doing the dives and flying around and doing Phoenix splashes and stuff. So Rollins is still one of the best that they have in the company. But yeah, both guys noticeably different when they first came back and in the years following those injuries. But pre-injury, I gotta buy on Triple H. So if you have mailbag questions, keep sending them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I do have two quick announcements here. First of all, a lot of you have been asking me, are we going to be doing a meetup? SummerSlam weekend, it's coming up in about a month. Are we doing another meetup? Last year, we had partnered with Mania Crawl. We did a joint meetup at this great beer hall in Brooklyn, only a few blocks away from the arena. Obviously, they're coming back to the Barclay Center again for NXT, for SummerSlam, Raw, SmackDown. As of right now, I'm not going to any of the shows, although I'm going to probably go to NXT. I would like to go at least to NXT. And whether I do or I don't, what I've decided is this. We are going to do a meetup, SummerSlam weekend. It will be that Saturday, August 19th. That is the day of the NXT TakeOver show, not SummerSlam. This is the day before SummerSlam. It'll be at 2 p.m. that afternoon on the 19th at the KBH, which is the same place we had the meetup last year. It's very spacious. It was a good place. Everybody seemed to enjoy it. There's tables where you can sit or you could just stand and kind of mooch around. The name has changed a little bit. It was the KBH, but it had like a German, it was like a German beer hall. Now it's expanded. It's all international flavors and drinks and stuff. It's King's Beer Hall, but the initials are still the same. The KBH, it's on St. Mark's Place in Park Slope, only a few blocks away from the Barclay Center. I'll make a Facebook invite this week. I'll put the Facebook invitation up. You can RSVP to it. It'll have the address in there and all the information. And this is not a joint meetup or anything. It's just a very casual sound-off meetup. I will be there. I hope you can make it out. Even if you're not going to the NXT show that day, which I may or may not be going, but I'll still be there. If you're in the area, come on down. And I look forward to seeing everybody there. I'll talk more about it in the weeks to come. So that is the tentative plan as far as that goes. And also tentative, I will be on Wrestling Soup with Mish and Joey Numbers this Thursday. I believe at 9:30, if I'm not mistaken. So that should be a lot of fun. It's been a while since I've been on there. So that about wraps it up. Enjoy Battleground. If you are watching the pay-per-view tonight, I will have a review up on the YouTube channel sometime later tonight or very early tomorrow morning after the show. So you can check out my sound-off extra review for Battleground. You will not have to wait a week. We'll have that up on YouTube tonight. Please hit the subscribe button if you are not already subscribed to the channel. Check out my Justin Roberts interview, well over an hour long. Very cool guy, very good interview, very insightful. If you want to hear from somebody who worked behind the scenes and on camera, but saw a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff and worked with the very top senior-most people in WWE for over a decade, and you want to get an honest sense of how things are, this is the interview that you want to listen to. You want to read the book. And I would say read the book first, but definitely check out my interview with him. It's up on YouTube. Please share with others as well. So until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll be back with episode 506 next Sunday and a brand new extra tonight on YouTube. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, wait, aren't you going to put any pants on? He just goes, no time for pants, and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. See, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.